Ho, ho, ho. It's Christmas in Springwood.
Naughty.
That wrong everything, David. I am your host, Henrik Kuto, here with my co-host, David DeNoyer.
Hello.
Also known as, he prefers to be called Double D.
Double D indeed.
Or Tutti Frutti.
Tutti Frutti. Forgot about that one. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. We never forget.
It's already feeling like Christmas.
I know, right? Well, this is the Freddy's Nightmares podcast. Welcome to Primetime, Freddy's Nightmares Retrospective. And this is our episode right before Christmas.
Yes, it is.
So, which means,
bitch,
that we need to be celebrating. We need to be in the mindset, Dave.
And as a special added bonus with this episode, it takes place at Christmas.
It does.
We did not count on that, actually.
To be honest, I was not expecting that.
No.
So, not only that, oh my God. We'll get
there's
into
a lot
that.
To unpack in this
there's
one.
A whole lot to unpack. This episode is fascinating.
Bonkers.
To me. Bonkers, I don't think, is even a fair assessment.
Assessment,
there's
no,
so
it's not.
Much going on.
There really is.
And that's why it's really fascinating to me. But first,
yes.
I want to say, because this is our 12th episode
yes.
of Welcome to Prime Time, thank you so much for listening.
Yes, thank you so much.
If you're enjoying this show, and why would you? We'd really appreciate if you would give us a make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcast app and give us a 5-star rating, because that really helps raise awareness of the show, and it costs you not a penny.
Not at all.
So if you get a chance, please do that for us. You could consider that a Christmas present to David and I.
There we go.
I really would appreciate it a lot.
Yeah,
and,
we would.
We've waited until we were over 10 episodes in to start with the begging.
That's true. We did get halfway through season one before we started putting out our cup for the change.
Yes. Please, sir. And I want to mention next week's show.
Yes.
I can't wait. We have to give, because this is our Christmas gift to you all.
Yes, go ahead.
Next week's show, we are going to be featuring the one and only Alan Katz.
Yes, and it was, I can't believe we got him for one.
Our first of hopefully many interviews with people who have worked on Freddy's Nightmares. Alan Katz was the lead writer on Freddy's Tricks and Treats.
Yep.
And he wrote several episodes in the second season, which we'll get to inevitably.
Yes.
It is inevitable.
And his writing partner was Gilbert Adler, the producer of the show as well.
The main producer on Freddy's Nightmares. And they went on to be the team behind Tales from the Crypt from season 3 onward.
Yes.
They were also the team behind Demon Knight and Bordello of Blood. So that is next week's show. We will not be covering one episode. We'll be having a long, awesome conversation with Al Katz.
Very excited.
So I just wanted to tease that, because that's the next step in the evolution of the podcast is to start talking to people who did this show or who were affected heavily by the show.
And there's a lot of names out there too.
There's a shocking amount of people who got great opportunities thanks to Freddy's Nightmares. But now, my friends, today is all about season 1, episode 12, The End of the World.
The End of the World, indeed. And the original air date is either January 14th or 15th, 1989. It's pinned if you go off of IMDb or Wikipedia. You got to do
January,
two dates.
It's Christmas time.
So this episode is directed by Jonathan Arbuteau. If that name sounds familiar, he was the writer of 1984's The Last Starfighter, the Nick Castle sci-fi film.
Oh, yeah. Nick Castle, who was The Shape.
The Shape, yes.
That's Michael Myers. In Halloween.
He was also the director of My Science Project in 85, but probably his most notable accomplishment and or credit, I would say, is he is the director of 1995 Whoopi Goldberg vehicle Theodore Rex.
So have I ever told you my story about Theodore Rex?
You have not. And now I would like to know.
For those who don't know, Theodore Rex is a movie that stars Whoopi Goldberg and a dinosaur.
Yes. Yes, it does.
I thought that that movie was a dream I had when I was a child. I'm serious. I'm not joking.
Yeah.
I guess it was on like HBO or something at night. And for 5, 6, 7 years, I thought that I dreamt that.
I got that movie and dinosaurs crossed a lot because the characters looked a lot alike.
What are you trying to say about dinosaurs, Dave?
Oh, you know exactly what I'm saying.
Guys, don't be mad at Dave. It's how he was raised. He can't help it.
So the episode was also written by James Capp. He's the writer of two episodes in this season. He's also going to come back for season one, episode 20, Light at the End of the Tunnel. And he goes on to write the screenplay for The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, a movie called Dark Justice. And he does six episodes of Poltergeist Legacy.
He's had quite a television career.
Yes, he has.
So, and JC, if you're listening, he wrote us an email.
He did.
And we're trying to get him to come on the show and talk a little bit. Because, to be honest, this may be, so far, the most strictly interesting episode
yes.
of Freddy's Nightmares because of the places it goes. So, I guess without further...
Bitch.
We will...
Let's dive into it.
We are going to dive in. So, get comfortable, my friends, because it's... Christmas.
Christmas in Springwood,
Ohio.
Oh, buddy. So the episode opens as we are introduced immediately to the infamous glove of Mr. Freddy Krueger.
Yes.
And he comes up into frame with a deflated ball that magically blows up in his hand, and then he tosses the ball off screen as we cut to two young girls running with the ball in their hand.
Like two young children.
Two young children.
He just threw a ball to. That's
They're
fine.
Running around the side of a house outside while a mom is up high. Is she watering the plant? Or
she's on a ladder.
Yeah, she's on the ladder attending to a plant, it looks like. And basically, we then see Amy Collins, who's played by Mary Connor. She was known as playing Tess Aldini on Star Trek The Next Generation. She was in
yes.
Big Man on Campus, Beyond the Door 3. She's watching the two girls run across the street as they approach a car, and they end up throwing the ball inside of it. One of the girls then gets into the car, tries to retrieve the ball, but does so by putting the car accidentally into drive.
And this is how we head into what has become one of my favorite tropes of Freddy's Nightmares,
yep.
which is the soulless and harsh exploitation of deep-seated trauma.
No kidding. So the car then plows into the ladder that the mother is on, knocking the mother to the ground violently. Amy watches this in horror as the little girl looks up from inside the car crying, and she has a little blood coming off the side of her forehead from a head wound. Suddenly, Amy wakes up, and she's in her bedroom revealing this all to be a dream.
And revealing,
yes.
Christmas in Springwood,
oh,
because
buddy.
We see our Christmas tree.
That we do. And I want to go back to this fall on the ladder quick, because we get to see this several times throughout the
yes.
episode. So I wanted to bring attention to the stunt person that's on most of the episodes so far. I've been keeping track of it just because I've been waiting to see when we get a really good stunt to bring this guy's name up.
Yeah, it's a hell of a fall.
Hell of a fall. His name is Joe Stone. He did all the stunts for Freddy's Nightmares that I could find so far, but I wanted to go through his career real quick to tell you a little bit about what he did before.
And stunt people are kind of like directors of photography.
Yeah.
They really work and work and work. Because I pointed out to you before
yeah.
that whenever you're looking at trivia, look at the director of photography.
Yes.
Because you'll be like, oh, this guy did, you know, this is 40 for Judd Apatow. And I'm like, yeah, but look at his credits. And you'll be like, oh, Strip to Kill 2 Live
yep.
Girls.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, they work and work and work.
So Joe Stone, one of his first credits was in 1980. He did the stunts for the Blues Brothers. He then goes on.
Wait, 19- there were stunts in the Blues Brothers?
Oh, do you not remember all
that,
the cars?
That talk fest? The Blues Brothers? See, that was Dave almost not getting the joke.
I hate you sometimes.
Merry Christmas, David.
So 1982, he then does Sword and the Sorcerer. He did Blue Thunder in 1983, and then he keeps going up with that. 1984, Up the Creek. 1985, Clue. 1986, Murphy's Law.
Wait, Murphy's Law?
Murphy's Law.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. You mean, whoa.
Charles Bronson.
Charlie Bronson.
One
hey,
of,
wasn't Bronzy the guy that does movies now? Wasn't he a stunt double?
Would you stop with that?
Dave one time made up trivia and said it like it was fact. And then I Googled it and couldn't find it. So, hey, Dave, and look at it this way.
Yeah.
It's your Theodore Rex.
That's my Theodore Rex.
It's just the opposite.
Continuing Joe Stone, 1989, Chud 2, Bud the Chud. 1989, The Package with Gene Hackman.
Okay, well... Man, that's got to be rough, though, going from Bud the Chud to having to slum it on a Gene Hackman
movie.
You know?
Oh, well, that's okay, because after that, Phantom of the Mall, Eric's Revenge.
Man, stunt people really do everything. For those out there uninitiated, if you've never seen Chud 2, Bud the Chud, It is the silliest movie. Like, it's almost bizarre how well put together the movie is for how silly it is.
No, it really is silly.
It's a bizarre little film, but it is very funny. There are just so many weird scenes. Like, there's a scene where a guy is getting his hair cut.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't understand these kids these days. The society's so dangerous. You know, when I was a child, my father would lay all of our valuables on the lawn before we went to sleep at night, and we woke up, they'd all still be, like, it's just such a weird thing, but then there's zombies, lots and lots of zombies, but, and then Phantom of the Mall, Eric's Revenge, you brought that movie
to me. Yes, I did.
And that is a...
hell of a film.
A bizarre slasher movie that's mostly Phantom of the Opera, but it's in a mall.
In a mall, yeah.
And a guy named Eric might get his revenge, I can't remember.
So then to cap off Mr. Joe Stone, so 1989, what we're talking about right now, Freddy's Nightmares, he then goes on to do a little film in 1990 called The Rookie, the Clint Eastwood vehicle. And then he also goes on to do In the Line of Fire in 1993, another Clint Eastwood vehicle. And then he caps off with Copycat in 1995, the Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter thriller from the 90s.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's a great one.
Well, you said Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter, so obviously I want to watch it.
Oh, and Dermot Mulroney, he's also in it. And Will Patton. Oh, yeah, we got to watch Copycat. Copycat's phenomenal.
All right.
So that's Joe Stone. So back to the episode. We move downstairs as Amy's father, played by Robert Benditti, he comes to Freddy's Nightmares having been in Newhart, Crime Story, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, the film. Mm. My Stepmother's an Alien, which were both in 88, so right before this.
Okay.
He's pouring liquor into a glass of eggnog. And the
Where would you recommend he pour it?
My mouth.
Oh.
Hey.
That sounds about right, actually. Guys, Dave likes to drink. He likes to drink a little bit every now and
then. So Amy comes downstairs. The house is decorated for Christmas. She comes out asking Mr. Collins if she can have some of the eggnog, and he comments it's a little too rich for her because she didn't see him pour the booze into it, obviously.
Because she has no clue he's a drunk living with him every day. And the fact that he looks like a drunk.
Some of his moments that we'll get to in the episode really broke my heart.
I can't call him disheveled. I have to call him unsheveled.
Unsheveled.
No, he's a really tragic character.
No, he really makes
me really sad, actually.
We will get there. So Amy comments that her dad looks tired and could use some breakfast. Her father jokes he's going to fast for a year and ask Amy if she has school. She comments that she has school and an appointment with her therapist, Dr. Clark. Amy leaves and her father raises a glass stating, "Holiday spirits, go without guilt," as Amy rushes out the door.
Bitch.
So Amy and her friend Jill, played by Lisa Pincott, making her debut in Freddy's Nightmares, actually, she'll go on to be in Falcon Crest, Say Anything with John Cusack, Married with Children, and she also did the movie Strange Days, which is a great sci-fi thriller.
Oh, yeah, I like Strange Days a lot.
Phenomenal. They return to Amy's house, discussing outfits for an upcoming dance. Amy comments her new haircut isn't to her liking as it shows what she calls her mutant forehead. Jill tells her she looks fine and to pick her up at 7:30 for the dance or she's vaporized. I love that line.
That's so 80s. Pick me up at 7 or you're vaporized.
Vaporized.
Tubular.
So Jill leaves and Amy brushes her hair back, revealing a medium-sized scar above her left eye.
I like that you said medium-sized scar.
Yeah.
Because this is David's interpretation, medium-sized scar. It makes me think of Ready Player One.
Yeah.
How there's that one character, the lead female character. She's just a very attractive woman with like a minor scar in her head, and everybody's like, oh, she's hideous. Like, we're all trying not to vomit when she's around. It's kind of similar vibe, though, with her. She's like a very pretty woman.
Yeah.
And she's got this like very unnoticeable scar.
If her hair's over, you can barely see it. So Jill leaves and Amy brushes her hair back, like I said, revealing the scar. Amy is next seen in Dr. Clark's office. Now, Dr. Clark is played by George Lazenby, which if you don't know that name,
I mean, come on.
Shame on you. He was famously known as James Bond on Her Majesty's Secret Service. He was also in a movie that I showed Henrik a couple years back because I'm a big fan of Ozploitation, which is Australian exploitation films.
Yes, yes.
There's a movie in 1974 called The Man from Hong Kong.
Oh, man, that movie's awesome.
Yes, and Lazenby plays the villain and has a infamous fire stunt in the movie that went horribly wrong.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
I can't recommend The Man from Hong Kong enough. But yeah, Lazenby.
It's a co-production, an Australian Hong Kong co-production.
So good.
Insane fight scenes. Insane
car
action.
Chases. Yeah, oh my God.
Insane car crashes.
So he is in his office discussing her checkup. She comments that she is concerned about her father's loneliness. Dr. Clark offers to call and check up on him. Amy then brings up that her concern with dreams she's having lately about people getting hurt or worse and how real it all feels until she wakes up.
And he's like, yeah. Intense violent dreams. I hear it all day long.
All the time.
You just are sexually frustrated.
So Dr. Clark comments that it's part of growing up, which I did love this line that he gives.
Oh, yeah.
So he comments that it's part of growing up. An adult life is how dreams change from monsters being under your bed and being naked in school to it's no comparison of responsibility, money, and nuclear disaster.
Is that foreshadowing?
So he assures her it's normal and that there's nothing to worry about. Amy is then seen back in her nightmare as she watches the two little girls run towards the car again, chasing the ball. But this time, one of the little girls falls down in the driveway, causing her legs to then be ran over, up close, mind you, a little child. And you see a close-up of these legs getting crushed by this car.
This episode's got so much going for it.
It really does. So the chick gets run over, once again, knocking the mother off the ladder again. Amy watches in horror across the street. We then see a close-up of the little girl screaming with the head wound as she looks up with a very bloody mother figure who is now deceased on the lawn. And my God,
they
the
just
gore.
Doused her in blood. Oh my God. Like, horrific.
So Amy wakes up again, realizes it's 8 p.m. and goes to call Jill to apologize for being late. Jill answers and is puzzled by what Amy is apologizing for. Amy explains she just needs 10 minutes and she'll be over to pick her up. Jill still acts confused and Amy reminds her they're going to go to the dance. Jill suddenly audibly gets upset and Amy tells her that she thought she was excited to show off her legs on the dance floor. Then Jill tearily asks, "Why are you doing this? I thought we were friends." And the camera cuts to Jill, who is now wheelchair bound.
Oh, here comes Freddy. I was hoping he'd take the holiday off, but here he comes.
He's early.
Hey, bitch.
Hey, Freddy. Merry Christmas.
It's happy holidays.
Oh, my apologies.
Wow. I didn't know you were so sensitive.
Listen, I'm just here to say how wrong it is to insult your friend who's bound to a wheelchair. I mean, what a lame joke.
Oh, Freddy.
I guess that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's not bad.
What, I mean, I'm not rolling on the floor laughing at that one.
Well, thank you, Freddy, so much.
I'm just saying.
Oh, God.
I won't stand for it.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Freddy, thank you.
Hey, kids, I'll be back a little later.
Oh, no.
It's Christmas, and I haven't forgotten you.
Oh, jeez.
Freddy out.
Bye, Freddy.
Bye, Freddy. God. No, the door's a pull. How many times has he used it? It's a pull. Okay, you got it.
I mean, last time you just went through the wall like a Looney Tune, so, you know, there's that.
I was like, what is this, part six?
So, Amy is seen next back at Dr. Clark's office trying to explain how her dreams caused Jill to become wheelchair-bound. Dr. Clark knows of Jill and explains that she has always been in a wheelchair. Amy then argues that she wasn't in a wheelchair yesterday and she knows her all her life. Dr. Clark tries to reassure Amy that she just needs a good night's sleep, which, my God, how many times is that going to be used?
Well, David, you need to understand that in Springwood, most ailments are related directly to not enough sleep. In fact, I wonder, because he prescribes your sleeping pills.
Yes, he does.
I wonder, can Springwood pharmacies even keep sleeping pills in stock? They're the most prescribed medication by a large margin. I feel like if you're in Springwood and you were at like your GP, you'd be like, "Well, I have liver cancer." You'd be like, sleeping pills. That's
there
what
you
go. Need.
That's unique.
Yep. You just need a good night's sleep to get that taken care of.
So Dr. Clark writes her prescription. Amy gets the pills and is next seen throwing them in the trash before getting into bed. She's back in the dream again, watching the little girls make their way towards the car. She looks up at the mom on the ladder as the car begins to go into drive. Amy runs across the street, pulls the little girl from the car before throwing the other out of harm's way. She safely holds the little girl in her arms as we hear off screen once again as the car hits the ladder, knocking the mother to the ground again. Amy wakes back up and realizes now that her scar is gone.
And I just want to point out,
yeah,
we're having a conspicuous lack of Freddy.
That we are.
And that is not necessarily a complaint.
No.
It's just, to be honest, I'm more nervous when he's not around.
Well, can we also agree how odd it was for them to show his break, the preview like of the screen right at grab the at the beginning?
They do it a little once or twice. Yeah. But I just want to point out, I mean, like, imagine what Freddy's doing when he's not letting us watch him. That's what I'm nervous about.
He's back under that couple's bed from that one episode.
Oh, yeah, he is. Oh.
So,
oh, Fred.
Amy wakes back up, realizing her scar is gone. She says out loud, realizing, the little girl was me. And the camera then zooms in behind her on a picture of the little girl from the dream, confirming that that is Amy and this is all true.
Which, that's the only part of this episode that actually, to be honest, kind of lost me. I thought that was very obvious.
Obvious.
That the little girl
was
her.
Well, and I also, we haven't mentioned it yet, but the dream is all in sepia. Like, it's no, got that it's yellowish
not,
tint to
no,
it.
No, it's not in sepia.
Oh, it's not?
No, because the color scheme is pink and green.
Ah.
Because not and here's what's going to make you feel like a real stupid piece
of
shit.
Oh, I'm ready. So, like, this changes already any there, fucking already day.
So the car is green.
Yeah.
And they've kind of added like a coloring to kind of give it this like pinkish hue.
Yeah.
The kitchen is pink and green too.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Holy shit.
Which I noticed immediately because it's unusual how like it's pink and green pastels. Pink and green, which I'm guessing maybe is a hint toward red and green, maybe. Yep. Not for, well, for Christmas or for
bitch
Freddy. So, but like, no, that's something I noticed right away was that it looks like they really tried to hype up the greens and the pinks.
So, speaking of Freddy's sweater real quick, I recently took in a rewatch of Home Alone. And have you ever noticed that the pizza boy at the very beginning who's delivering the pizzas to the house has a Freddy like shirt on basically? Like it's the red and the green.
It's a Christmas movie.
It's a Christmas movie, yes. But like it looks exactly like Freddy's.
See, I thought for a second you were gonna be like, have you ever noticed that the guy who delivers the pizza at the beginning has a long history of child abuse allegations? Oh, and I'd be like, what? Not the actor, the character. Oh, how do you know that, David? I had got this golden ticket from an old guy.
Oh my God. I don't know if I go into Home Alone though. I don't know if that's the movie I would go into.
I feel like if you had the golden we're such freaking nerds. If I had the golden ticket from Last Action Hero.
Yes.
Home Alone is like the best place to go because apparently you're immortal in that universe.
There is because,
but not immune to pain, just immune to death.
Let's be honest though, you would go into Tremors.
Yeah, but that's just for the so I could pay for land at 1990s prices in the desert.
And
you know?
Me, Burt Gummer.
I would totally hang with Burt Gummer. It would take forever for Burt to like me, though.
I think you'd try to convince him to leave Reba McEntire.
Oh, well, she's not. She doesn't deserve him.
So, back to Springwood. Amy is next seen going through the cabinet downstairs. She pulls out a picture of her mother, and her father catches her and telling Amy that she's a spitting image of her, and that's why he doesn't keep any pictures of her around except that one. Amy confronts her father for not telling her how the mother died, and her father argues back that he did. It was an accident, and she hit a tree. Amy knocks the boozy eggnog from his hand, shattering it to the floor, and tells him that her and Jill playing in front of the car, it was an accident when the car ran into the ladder, knocking her mother to the ground and breaking her neck, killing her. Amy argues it wasn't an accident, it was a nightmare. Mr. Collins then becomes tearful as he recounts it wasn't her fault and it was an accident and he couldn't bear to tell her.
Yeah.
He then goes into this really heartfelt.
Yeah, no, this whole thing is like usually in Springwood, whether it's the movies or the series, it's parents. I swear, sometimes it feels like parents just lie to kids for the sake of lying.
Yeah.
But this one, actually, he was protecting her.
He really was.
So, no, please continue.
He recalls the story about what happened, and he was at the airport getting ready for a business trip when he got the call from Dr. Clark stating that Emily, his wife, had a freak accident and he needed to come home. He states he was trying to protect Amy from having to live with the rest of her life. Mr. Collins then asks Amy how she found out, which she replies she dreamed it, which puzzles Mr. Collins. The two are then interrupted as Jill, who can walk now, enters the room and Amy is shocked, revealing that Jill has full mobility of her legs again.
Yeah, I guess that friendship can stand on its own after all.
Damn it, Henrik.
What? What did I do?
Amy is back now in Dr. Clark's office telling him how her dreams changed things to where Jill got her mobility back and how the scar is gone now, too. Dr. Clark, of course, is having none of it and saying that she never had the scar and Jill could always walk. He continues that if Amy believes that she can do it right, she can go back and save her mother now in the dream.
And I want to say, big props to this episode. It does mind fuckery very well.
Very well.
Like, like every time she wakes up, things are just different.
Yeah.
And I really like that because that's great writing.
No, it's super good.
That's not because that's the thing. You can have great special effects. You can have great action scenes. But when you have great writing, it takes no effort to make the audience go, what?
Yeah.
Like they didn't have to like actually cripple someone and then uncripple them. You know, it's just writing. It's just in the writing. So I just wanted to say I was very, very pleased with the way I started to lose my grip on the reality of the episode, the way she is, the way the main character is.
And when we get into the second half here in a bit too, it just completely changes it to another dynamic that still works too.
Yeah, I agree.
So Amy is seen next laying on the bed, holding a picture of her mother and telling her that she's coming for her and she's going to stop the car as she fades off to sleep. She comes back into the dream and little Amy is seen getting behind the wheel of the car. She puts it into drive as the car lurches forward. Amy yells for young Amy to stop before running across the street and getting into the car, hitting the brakes before it collides with the ladder. Amy then wakes up in a room and answers to a knock on the door as a female voice asks if she's okay. Amy asks who is it as her mother, played by Judith Flanagan, who comes to Freddy's nightmares having done Dynasty. She was Eddie's mother in the 1988 Blob.
Oh!
The good Blob.
Whoa.
Oh, I'm throwing shade.
You hate the original Blob.
I don't hate the original, but you cannot beat that remake. It is so freaking good.
David hates the original Blob.
Chuck Russell's The Blob is great.
What about Ken Russell's The Blob?
That didn't happen, and now I wish it did. You've made me sad. So she enters, and Amy tells her that she loves her. Amy then asks where her father is, and her mother tells her to stop it. Amy asks again, and she asks what's wrong and where's dad. Mrs. Collins then feels Amy's forehead, commenting she's going to make an appointment with Dr. Clark before Amy asks again, and her mother tells her that her father is dead, and it's been years. It happened the day the car almost hit her. She tells her that a small plane off course as her father was flying for a business trip, and it was a mid-air collision. Amy, of course, breaks down crying as her mom consoles her. The camera then pans down to reveal that the picture that was once her mother has now turned into her father.
And we're getting some serious butterfly effect stuff going right here. And I like that. I mean, and this episode really did bring up a lot of kind of classic Twilight Zone-y stuff.
Definitely, yeah.
Well, especially in the second half. But we're not there yet. We're almost, though.
Oh, but let's... So the A story
on,
ends.
I want to... Okay. But now she's got... This is going to be really tough for her because now she's got to switch from mommy issues to daddy issues. So I guess now she's going to have to become like an artist or a stripper or whatever it might be. I'm just saying.
I mean, I'm sure all those businesses that she can go to exist in Springwood, because as we know, they have fucking
everything.
Springwood
literally is a one-stop shop, everything you need right at your fingertips.
So the A story ends as the ball from the beginning rolls back into Freddy's domain. He picks it up, deflating it, and stating, like mommy and daddy always say, accidents happen.
And I want to know, how did Freddy know I was an accident? I want to know. Dave is, he needed a break to take a sip from his Rally's cup.
Thank you for that. So the B story begins as we are shown a POV of someone walking through a military base.
It's pronounced POV.
Oh, yes, a POV. They come to a door that is open with a key and enter a control room with a bunch of boards of buttons and switches. As a call comes over, an alarm sounds for a code to begin arming missiles. Missiles? Wow.
Whoa. Nice one, Dave. Missiles.
So the voice on the radio states that this is not an exercise, as an unseen figure and his partner arm the missiles and begin the launch countdown. We then cut to Amy watching the launch occur with fear in her eyes as an explosion goes. She wakes up back in her room, unsettled by the dream, and writes down the launch code from her dream on a pad, which, by the way, did you see her pad just had her name on it at the top?
Oh, yeah. How else would she know it's hers? I want to point out, as we were just joking, that Springwood has everything.
Yeah.
It also has nuclear missile silos, at least local.
Local.
We don't know that they're, like, in Springwood proper.
Yeah.
But they're nearby.
They're nearby.
And, you know, maybe that's why people don't take the Freddy thing seriously. They're just like, oh, these kids just have radiation poisoning. They'll be fine. Just need a good night's sleep to get over that.
As if we just didn't have enough Freddy in that last scene, we then cut to a globe on her desk that begins to spin and spin with an eerie rendition of Deck the Halls playing before it's revealed that Freddy is inside the globe as he cuts the globe off, stating, today, Springwood, tomorrow, the world. Kaboom! As a mushroom cloud appears above Freddy's head.
A poorly done video Mushroom Cloud. It's so good.
And again, I would like to talk about the break real quick, because when they have the breaks, of course, they show screen grabs from these Freddy scenes. Did you notice what they were doing towards the end of the episode, where they just kept like messing with, like, they were stretching the image and like blowing it up and super.
I'm not kidding. I think that after the one where DJ Freddy, I think that they started having fun with that.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I think they were either that or they were on really tight deadlines. So the editors were just like, dude, I've worked in post-production, and when we all get tired, we start goofing off and trying to sneak it into the projects. So I can't say what's happened not until the statute of limitations is lifted.
So Amy is next seen talking to Dr. Clark, who tells her her mother is concerned for her, and Amy begins to tell him that she's no longer having dreams about her life, and goes in to describe the military-based dream and shows Dr. Clark the launch code that she wrote down from the dream. Dr. Clark assures her that it's probably nothing, but Amy is distressed and leaves as Dr. Clark picks up the phone to call Langley, Virginia. Amy is next seen reading the bomb as she sits in her room, suddenly noticing a burned teddy bear on her on the couch with her. She goes to pick it up, but is stopped as a little boy who is burned from an explosion grabs it, saying, "Please save us."
And I gotta say, I'm surprised it's taken us 11 episodes to get to charred children. But this is, I'll get into why more later, but this part of the episode, the second half, is highly disturbing.
Oh, it's grim. It's very grim.
Oh my God. I mean, we're not saying like, haha, this kid's like skin is burned black with some red spots. His hair's all asunder.
And don't worry, we'll come back to him too.
Oh, we will.
So Amy wakes up from her bed asking for no more before her mom calls from downstairs telling her that there's a visitor for her. Amy goes downstairs and meets Jack Steers, played by Andrew Prine. That man, by the way, Andrew Prine, 184 acting credits on IMDb. He has credits starting as early as 1955 going to 2015. Everything from old TV like Quincy, Kolchak, Wonder Woman. Then we get to the good stuff. 1976, Grizzly.
Oh, man, I love Grizzly.
1976 again, The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yes.
Eliminators, Gettysburg, Deep Space Nine, and one of his last credits was Lords of Salem, the Rob Zombie film.
Oh, okay.
He actually passed a couple years after that.
Okay.
So he works for the CIA, and he's been contacted by Dr. Clark. We then see the POV of a military base again as a figure walks in.
But you forgot the best part.
Oh, what's that?
He's enjoying some milk and cookies
Christmas
time.
Yes.
And I want to point out how I like that the Springwood decor is just the smallest possible Christmas tree in every room.
Yes.
There's just a teeny tiny Christmas tree in a bedroom, in a kitchen, living room, in a dining room.
So we then see the POV of the military base again as a figure walks into the base, again like the dream. We are then introduced to Frank, who is played by Joseph Kell. He comes to Freddy's nightmares, having been in Knott's Landing, St. Elsewhere, JAG, CSI, a big TV player. He is then told by his partner, Neil, that this is not the job to show up late to, before commenting that Frank doesn't look so good. Frank comments he's fine and has just not been sleeping well before sitting down to the controls. We are then in the CIA office as Agent Sears sits at a table with contacts from other bases, including Kemmerling, who is played by the very famous Walter Gotell. He's famous for playing General Gogol in 6 James Bond films that include View to a Kill, Octopussy, Moonraker, The Spy Who Loved Me. But our listeners might know him more so as Uncle John in Sleepaway Camp 2.
Oh, yeah. I want you out of here before lunch.
He's also done Tales from the Crypt, Puppet Master 3. So there's also Colonel Delaney, who is played by Albert Hall. He comes to Freddy's Nightmares having been in Miami Vice, Fame, goes on to be in Malcolm X, Major Payne, National Treasure 2. The two of them with Sears are discussing Amy's ability to have the launch codes from a dream, which is for the first strike against the Soviet Union.
And I want to say, I feel like, is this where the U.S. military finally weaponizes Freddy? Because I'm just saying, the Ruskies can't win a war when all the young men die in their sleep before battle. That's all I'm saying. It reminds me of the South Park joke where they go find Freddy Krueger and he's like, "When I killed all those teenagers to stop communism, you said it was going to be over."
So the colonels are in disbelief, but Sears explains that they've investigated with squat found so far, so now they have to discover if she's telling the truth by putting her to the test. Frank is then shown back at home getting ready for work again as his wife asks if he's okay. He sits on the couch to read a paper and kind of starts to fall asleep as we cut to Amy, who's connecting with him and seeing what he sees. She comments Frank isn't at the base and that he's at home with his wife and son. She tells them he's in uniform and his name is Frank. We then cut back to Frank, who is completely dozed off at this point, and as he begins to dream, Amy loses the connection with them, telling them she's lost the connection. She questions Sears as to why she has to do this, and Sears tells her it's the only way to avoid a catastrophe.
Now, if you had told me that Freddy's Nightmares was going to have a remote viewing subplot when we started this show, I would have laughed at you. Then again, I always laugh at you, Dave.
That's fair.
So, but
every day.
But I want to point out, you know, a lot of people listening to this are like us. They either didn't exist in the 80s, which was why it was a better time, like you.
Hey, now.
Or they were born in the 80s, like me.
Yeah.
A lot of you guys listening, you know, we all watch this on home video. Remote viewing was a thing that the government was actually looking into to try to fight the Russians. And the Russians were doing the same thing. It's like when you watch Stranger Things.
Yeah.
They really were doing psychic research. It's just that it was all bupkis. It didn't really lead to anything. But when this show was written, there was still this concept that, like, the government was still experimenting with this weird stuff. Forget MK Ultra and mind control and stuff. They were trying to see if people could sit in a room and see across the world. It's nuts.
Crazy. It's
nuts.
No, it's crazy.
And I love that this, it gives this even more of an 80s flavor.
Yeah. No,
and I never would have imagined that we would be talking about remote viewing on this podcast.
Let alone on a Christmas episode.
Well, I mean, Santa Claus is the original remote viewer.
That is true.
Yeah. God, it's like
he sees you when you're sleeping.
He knows when you're awake.
And
he knows if you've been bad or good. So be good for
something.
Shut up, Dave.
So Sears guides Amy to concentrate once again as we cut back to Sears, who wakes up, or cuts back to Frank, who wakes up on the couch. His family is now playing Scrabble. Amy then emerges into the home, telling them that she's in the living room with them and something is different. Frank's son, Billy, plays the word nuclear on Scrabble as the family looks up at Amy, almost inviting her to come closer.
Yeah.
Billy then plays the word war as suddenly his teeth fall out, hitting the Scrabble board.
Yeah.
Billy comments, "Hey, my teeth. Oops."
Yeah, so the family starts having radiation poisoning.
Yes, they do.
Aggressively. And this is really fucking me up, Dave.
No, it's bad.
No. But I'm going to tell you why.
Yeah.
When I was a child, I had reoccurring nightmares of nuclear war.
No shit.
I'm not kidding. To the point where I would write about it in school.
Yeah.
And they called my mom because they were like, "Your son seems to be very afraid of nuclear war." And I'm positive it had nothing to do with watching Terminator 2 every other day of the week on VHS.
I was going to say, is this where you also tell our listeners about how you've told me often about how anytime you had a creative writing prompt in school, it became Terminator 2?
Well, that was to be funny. That was in my teens when I was a little shit. No, when I was a child, I just thought that nuclear war was a very real possibility,
yeah.
And it scared the crap out of me. So I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
The more they escalate with the charred children, yeah, and the radiation poisoning and all this stuff, the more I get really unnerved.
Yeah.
And I had just listened a few weeks back to an episode of the show I listened to with Andrew Heaton called The Political Orphanage. He did an episode all about how what happens when nuclear bombs actually go off.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a 3-hour show. And he broke down everything about like how much you can actually survive
and what
the things you have to do and stuff. And
talk about timing.
It's a great episode. I can't recommend it enough, but like it will mess you up.
Yeah.
He also points out that that there was one guy who survived both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. By total coincidence, he was at both. But anyway, my point is, this is fucking me up.
Yeah. No. It gets fucked up because as we start to go, so the kids' teeth are falling out. Then Amy notices her hair is falling out along,
yes,
with Frank's wife. Sears tells, so the family is just starting to have all these radiation. Amy notices her hair is falling out along with Frank's wife. Like I said, Kemmerling isn't buying any of this. So Sears tells him to entertain the idea it's real and there's got to be a way that they can use her. Suddenly, Amy begins to spout off another launch code that Frank plays on the Scrabble board before Kemmerling orders them to call NORAD and check it. Back in Frank's dream, Amy questions Frank how he could do this as the TV breaks in, stating there is a full-scale nuclear attack that shakes the house, waking Frank from his dream. He then tells his wife he will see her later before leaving for work. Colonel Delaney confirms that Amy dreamed up the new launch code that NORAD confirmed, and Amy is then questioned what she saw, to which she says, "I saw the end of the world."
So, you hear how intensely David was reading that? That's how the episodes played.
Oh, yeah.
We're now on our way to global nuclear annihilation.
And we are bouncing, the way that this is edited is done so well because we're bouncing back and forth between Amy and Frank, who are both technically in the same dream, but you also have the urgency of them trying to call and confirm because this is about to happen.
This reminded me a bit of that Monsters episode.
Yeah.
With the nuclear war. I don't want to spoil how it ends, but a really good episode of Monsters, the anthology TV series. But I want to point this out. So now all of a sudden we're back at the missile silo.
Yes.
And this guy is being forced to launch a nuclear weapon.
Yes.
And all I could think was like, Jesus Christ, Freddy's trying to nuke the world now. Like, like I know, I fucking know he's evil, but like, I guess there really isn't a ceiling at all.
Apparently not.
Freddy's just like, let's end human life as we know it.
Oh, we'll get there. Oh boy, will we get
what
there.
What I'm trying to say is holiday viewing at it.
Oh god.
I want to mention, because we always forget to mention at the beginning, these episodes are all available at Tubi TV for free to watch with commercials. So anyway.
So we're back at the base now. Frank returns to work and begins his shift. Delaney confirms that there are 26 ICBM sites with a guy named Frank who is married with one son and on duty as we speak. So that's 26 people at these bases, and they have to narrow it down to one, and we are down to minutes.
We're down to the wire here, folks.
So Agent Sears is preparing Amy to go back to the dream and prompts Amy to share everything she is seeing. We cut back to the base as Frank has dozed off, but suddenly awakens, sweating and looking very distressed. Kemmerling comments they need to find the exact reference point that this is coming from, whether it's a shared nightmare or really happening. Amy comments this is happening right now, which prompts Kemmerling to state they need to find out the exact base location. Delaney tells her to look for the identifying base number to the left of the board. Amy reads out the numbers, and Delaney then calls NORAD back to locate it. Back at the base, Frank rises from a chair, walks over to Neil, who's working, and hits him, knocking him out. Amy reports this, that Frank is typing something in the computer, and Delaney confirms the missile silo is in Nebraska and has just gone into complete communications intervention shutdown.
Yes, and so at this point, he takes his partner hostage because it's kind of like the nuclear submarine thing where you have the two keys that have to turn at the same time on top of having the codes and everything.
And if things couldn't get more urgent, they also state that Frank has just changed the missile target right where they are standing. So the coordinates of this missile are going to hit the office, the CIA location that everyone is at. Frank draws his gun, shooting the board control, locking himself in the room. Security teams scramble to try and get in the office as they go to work on the door. Kemmerling, Sears, and Delaney discuss that Frank cannot launch the missile without the key turned from his partner. Kemmerling questions how a sleepwalking psycho wound up with his trigger finger, quote, on the big banana.
I mean, you think that's bad. You see what the Russians were doing at the same time. I imagine that simultaneously, like, Jason Voorhees was just messing everything up in Russia. Like, Gorbachev was like, we have to stop this man with the mask.
Does he have the mask and the hat?
Oh, yeah, of course. We have to stop him with our trained bears.
God. So
Los Madonia. Like, he's going to kill us.
Oh, you better be careful saying his name.
I will never say it again. I apologize.
Frank
Freddy.
Pulls his gun on Neil and tells him to get ready to turn the key on his mark as they go into standby.
Yeah, and what a terrible soldier. He's like he's going to do it. It's like, yeah, turn the key and kill millions or just you die.
Yeah.
You had one job. You had one job, which is not to accidentally or unintentionally launch nuclear weapons. And you're like, well, wait, if it's my life, hold on.
All right. So he reluctantly turns the key and tries to argue with Frank, but Frank threatens to blow his brains out, which again, at that point, it's like, just kill me.
Yeah, like, we're all going to die anyway.
So Frank then tells him to prepare for the launch as he begs him to think about the people and war that they could start. His partner pulls the key out, refusing. As the silo door opens, the security team rust in, blasting Frank, killing him instantly.
They smoked his ass.
They light him up.
It was like Die Hard 2 level.
Yes.
Just brrr, and just tons
down.
Of squibs, and he is down, dead as a fucking door fuck.
So killed instantly, Delaney gets the news that everything is okay as Amy screams no before coming out of the dream, stating he's dead and it wasn't his fault.
I love that part where she says, he's dead. And it's like, well, yeah, sweetie, we're the CIA. That's what we do.
So she says it wasn't his fault. It was the nightmares. Sears comments she's done well and wants her to relax and get a good night's sleep so they can start all over again tomorrow.
Yes, they're going to weaponize Amy, which is such a great ending.
Yeah, Amy this questions.
This episode's really good.
It is. Amy questions again, and Sears tells her that they've got a couple other things that they want to look into.
We then cut to the Russians. We'll have to bring out our own weapon.
Oh, God.
Comrade Voorhees, reporting for duty.
If only.
I know, right?
Instead. Instead.
This.
Oh, yes.
This. Oh, my God, so, this.
The episode ends as we're shown an image of Earth when suddenly a missile comes into the frame being rode as a cowboy style.
Freddy's rodeo riding a nuclear bomb because fuck you, it's Christmas. That's why.
And okay? He states, nah, I'd rather get you little buckaroos one at a time. Yeah,
you come cowboy.
You come cowboy indeed.
And that
is the end of the world as we know it.
And I feel not so fine, if I'm honest.
Oh, he said he's coming back.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Freddy. Oh, God.
Freddy, where on earth did you even get that costume?
Oh, I'm horrified right now.
Oh, man. And why does the bag you're carrying smell so bad?
Ho, ha, ha, ha! It's me, jolly old Saint Dick.
Go on.
That's a choice.
I'm here to give you two exactly what you deserve.
Let's review. He's put a pizza cutter in my head. He's carved a penis in my leg. What more could I want now?
This isn't about hurting anyone.
Oh.
This is about giving. In fact, today, I'm not Freddy. No, no, no. You just call me Santa Finger Knives.
What?
Santa Finger Knives?
No, wait, no, no. Not a stupid... I'm a regular Santa razor glove.
Freddy, what about Santa claws?
Yeah,
you know, because of the claws?
Claws.
I don't get it.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay, Freddy, there's no getting out of this. What did you get us for Christmas?
I'm so glad you asked. David,
yes.
Come here. Come here.
Okay.
Come here, little boy.
Oh, I'm not sitting on your lap.
Oh, yes, you are.
The hell I am.
Yeah, come on. Right here on my knee.
All right.
Oh, that's not my knee, but it is hard.
God damn.
Okay, chill up. You, David, get a big pile of spiders and Hanson CDs.
I mean, I like the spiders.
You do like spiders, and you like CDs.
I like CDs.
Good. See, ho, 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 ho.
Thank you, Freddy.
Okay. So, wait, what do I get? Because that bag smells really bad.
Yes, it
and
does.
It doesn't smell like spiders.
Oh, you, Enrique.
You know how to say my...
That's a dick move.
This is total dick move.
You get 24 pounds of pure uncut Peruvian cocaine.
What?
Why would I get that?
Merry Christmas!
I don't even drink alcohol.
No.
Why? Like, I appreciate that it's expensive and there's a lot of it, but these gifts don't make sense for either. And where would you even get that?
This says return to the cartel if lost.
Merry fuck you. I kill children.
Merry Christmas, Freddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And Happy Hanukkah, or whatever the hell it's called.
Oh, Jesus. Ah!
Freddy, it's still a pull. The door's
still a pull.
Well.
What just happened?
Those spiders are all alive.
Yeah.
I would assume when they were piled up on each other in that bag that they would start dying.
They're not even taking the Hanson CDs. They're taking my legs right now.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. That's so gross.
Mm-hmm. I don't feel... Oh, God. He's the gift that keeps on grieving at this point.
Well, on the plus side, this stuff is good.
Oh, God.
Like, really good.
Oh, Jesus.
Show business.
Good job, Freddie. Good job.
So,
Santa finger knives?
I guess it makes sense.
I guess.
In all sincerity, guys, we want to say thank you so much for joining us since October.
Yes.
And we want to wish you a very happy holiday season. It is Christmas coming right up, and it's also the second day of Hanukkah.
Yes.
So please just know, really, we appreciate you guys listening. If you get a chance, give us a rating on your favorite podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. It really would help us out. But before we go, we have one more set of recommendations for your holiday horror viewing.
But before we get to that, we need to rate the episode.
Oh, goodness. See, this is why David is in charge.
I try. So, Let's assess this real quick. So we have Freddy's interactions in the episode. I can't say a bad thing about them.
They're minimal, but boy, are they quality.
Top notch.
I mean, goodness gracious.
Story-wise, I thought it was pretty cohesive. I thought it moved very well. And overall, like you said, it's a very disturbing episode, but a very good episode. I'm going to give this a B.
You know, I'm going to give it a B+.
B+.
I think you could have taken Freddy out of it and made it just any show.
Yeah.
And
no,
I would have watched
absolutely.
It and enjoyed it.
Absolutely. So moving on to our recommendations, do you want to go first or you want me to?
I'll start with a classic. The film that I feel like is not only a holiday horror film, but it's actually a holiday horror film that makes me feel Christmassy.
Okay.
And I know that sounds weird, but so I'm going to recommend the classic, the eternal Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Yes.
That absolutely. Is a great horror movie for the holiday season. And in many ways, it started the Killer Santa trend.
Yeah, definitely.
And I love it.
No, it's so good. If you're not familiar with Silent Night, Deadly Night, first off, shame on you. But you basically Naughty. Have the story of a young kid who unfortunately witnesses his parents be killed by a Santa Claus one night.
Yes, yes, by a murderer dressed yes. as Santa Claus. They just happen upon him on Christmas Eve.
And that carries some trauma over the years.
You wouldn't think, but it's a movie, it's fiction.
But when he goes to work at a toy store, let's just say something happens that triggers him this special Christmas.
And it becomes just nutsoid. The thing about this movie is it's as cheesy as it is dourly sad.
Yes.
It really works. If you've never seen it or if you haven't seen it in a few years,
revisit it.
We're giving you some holiday horror suggestions. So that's my first one for the last Christmas episode we have this year.
So my first recommendation today, I'm going to go with the immortal classic, the Bob Clark 1974 Black Christmas, which if you have not seen, again, shame on you. And Black Christmas is the story about a sorority at Christmas time that is being plagued by, let's just say, threatening phone calls, menacing phone calls.
Obscene phone calls.
And some stuff starts to happen in regards of some of the girls go missing. And maybe there's somebody around that doesn't want Christmas to be so happy this year.
And his name might be Billy.
Might be Billy indeed. It's, like I said, directed by Bob Clark, who famously did Porky's as well as A Christmas Story.
A Christmas Story and Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Yes. Stars Margot Kidder, Olivia Hussey, and John Saxon. Highly, highly recommend it. Little bit of a slow burn, but
it's
well
worth it. It's
from the
70s, but it's a great one.
Yep. So what's your next one?
Well, mine is somewhat related. Mine is the 2007, I believe,
six,
2006 yeah. remake of Black Christmas that we all call Black Xmas,
yes.
although it is just Black Christmas 2006.
Yes.
It's incredibly underrated, although it's slowly starting to get appreciated.
It definitely is.
It is a chaotic, crazy remake.
Yeah.
And it is a remake.
Yes.
It takes a lot of different directions. It's so in that, like, that end of that era where like you're at the end of the Dawson Creek era in horror, but you're at the midst of like the Maxim magazine era of all entertainment. So you have these like impossibly good looking women at the sorority and this, it's so gory.
So gory. Like whereas 74's Black Christmas is you don't see a lot of it's off screen. It's a lot of implied in your mind. You have nothing left of the imagination in Black Xmas.
And it has a really good sense of humor.
Yes.
There's a part when they're at the mental asylum and they're walking through giving everybody their meals and they're like opening up and there's a crazy person who says, Merry Christmas. They open it up and the guy, Merry Christmas. They open up one and the guy clearly believes he's Jesus.
Yeah.
And they go, Happy birthday. Like that movie has so much to like in it.
It really does.
And that one is a crowd pleaser. Like you can put that on at your holiday party if everybody loves horror movies. I one year played it at midnight at my Christmas party.
I remember.
And it was probably the best experience playing a midnight movie at a Christmas party I've ever had.
100%.
So, and what's your last one, Double D?
My final is a little off track, but not really. So, there's a studio from the 60s and 70s called Amicus that was basically the, I don't want to say second hammer, but in a sense...
No, second hand hammer. Second they hand were the hammer. Low budget hammer.
They did movies such as Dr. Terror's House of Horror, The House That Dripped Blood, and they also did in 1972 a film entitled Tales from the Crypt, which is based off the EC Comics. A lot of people don't know that there was an original film before the TV series. This is directed by Freddie Francis, stars Joan Allen, Peter Cushing. The reason I bring this up as a Christmas movie is the first story with Joan Allen is actually the story that takes place in the very first season of Tales from the Crypt.
And all through the house.
And it's done very well. The movie centers about these five people that come into this domain of a guy that's basically the Crypt Keeper. And they get to find out why they are... at his domain, basically.
Yeah, and it's if you've ever watched any anthology movie ever, you know exactly why.
Yes.
They all have the same trope. I love it.
It's
but
so
they all
good.
The same trope. So those are your holiday horror recommendations. I hope if you're out there listening to this while you're doing things for the holiday, you take a second, take a deep breath, enjoy everything that's going on around you.
Yes.
It's been a very tumultuous holiday season for myself, but I'm working very hard to enjoy myself. Actually, Dave and I, as much as it pains me to admit this, we're going to hang out and watch some movies.
Yes, we are.
Right when we stop recording. So please take care and know that we will be back next week with a great episode. And we'll be back the week after that.
Yes.
Covering, that'll be season one, episode 13.
Yes, and that is going to
whoa,
be...
Whoa.
What?
13?
Oh, again, you are tempting fate, sir. So, yes, he is talking about season one, episode 13, Deadline, directed by Michael Lang, who I am excited because he did Mother's Day, episode 8.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we are going to be back, but now I guess it's time for us to go on our merry way. Pardon the pun. Thank you for listening to Welcome to Prime Time, a Freddy's Nightmares retrospective. If you'd like to send us a message. Whoa.
What?
It's Christmas. We have an email.
Oh, we do.
Now you guys know that we really do this show live.
On the fly.
So we got an email, and I wanted to read it on the show. And it's from Michael. He wrote us before, and I mispronounced his name because it is an otter. It is a stranger name. Mm-hmm. Michael Ashkawi. And he wrote in and said, "Hey, guys, Mike again." And then he mentioned how to pronounce it. He said, "Don't worry about it. It's still new to me as I'm reclaiming my indigenous name."
Mm.
Which, and I hear you, I have a Hispanic name and I grew up in the Midwest. So I say Henrik Cuto, but people
Heinrich.
It's not Heinrich, goddammit. But people will say, like, you know, how do you say it? And I'm like, honestly, you could say Enrique, yeah. You could say Henrik. I answer to both. Usually it's the white folk say Henrik and everybody else Enrique. But no, so I really do get that because I've even debated changing my, stopping pronouncing it the other way.
Yeah.
But I'm like, oh, I'm daunted by it. So all my heart goes out to you about, like, reclaim your name, man.
Yes.
Because it's who you are and it's important. He does say long story, so I won't bore you there. Anyway, it's the end of the year and I wanted to send you guys something nice in the form of an email.
Oh.
Recently, my family and I experienced the loss of a beloved pet, Dr. Wily, after the Mega Man bad guy. And it hit rather hard. One of the things that helped me during that time was listening to your show. When Wily was alive, I'd often put on the show on my Google Home and play Call of Duty, and he'd be curled up on my leg and go to sleep. Oh. It was a nice way to spend time together, and it hasn't been the same since he passed. I can't watch Freddy on Tubi in Canada for whatever reason, but I do have an old download of the series. I'm starting to re-listen to old episodes and watch along now. I really look forward to listening to your show each week, and hearing my name shouted out recently was a pick-me-up that I needed during all of this. I want to send my sincere thanks and gratitude for being entertaining and just being there during a difficult time. As a podcaster for 15 years, I know getting emails like this can really resonate, and it's nice to hear from the people whose lives you're touching. You both helped during a difficult time, and it's appreciated. I hope you both have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year. Thank you again from the bottom of my heart. In my language, we say Miigwetchi, which is thank you and Obajwi. I hope I said that right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Mike Ashkui.
Wow. That's awesome. Thank you for the letter, and I'm sorry about your pet. I know how hard that can be, and I also understand how it's the little things sometimes that just get you through those. So we're happy to be here for you, man.
Yeah. And I want to say,
bitch.
No, I had to break the tension a little. I've been dealing with my pets having some serious medical issues this entire month.
Yeah.
And I feel for you. But we're going to be here for you a minimum of 44 episodes.
We are.
And we're working on a lot more. So thank you for that heartfelt message. Sincerely, I'm going to start the ending back up. We're going to get out of here. But if you want to reach out and cut us like Mike did, you can send us an email at freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com and find all other information at freddysnightmares.com. But we're going to get out of here. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. And
bitch.